Fall is in the air and critters are on the move. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today for our monthly conversation, and today we're going to do the shuffle. We're going to talk about how animals get themselves ready for winter. Some creatures migrate thousands of miles, some hundreds, and some don't go far at all. We'll talk about fall migration and other preparations that our wild neighbors are making for the long winter months ahead. We'll also talk about how all of this movement can bring us into contact and occasional conflict with wildlife. We'll also be taking your calls at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll do the shuffle after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The nights are cool and cooler days are on the way. Fall is in the air and creatures all over Iowa are getting ready for winter. Jim Pease is an environmental, interpretive, and wildlife consultant based in Ames, and he joins us once a month to talk about Iowa's wildlife and wild places. And today, we, along with many of Iowa's critters, are going to be doing the fall shuffle. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. In fact, I'm doing the dance right here in the studio, but I realized it was radio.
So we shouldn't be surprised if you sound out of breath.
That's right.
What are some of the more visible signs that we can see that tell us that animals are starting to get ready for winter?
Well, I think that probably even the most casual observers of the outdoors may have already noticed some things. I went out this morning to pick raspberries in our raspberry patch, and these wonderful red, nice nuggets of nutrition, and noticed overhead hundreds, literally hundreds of monarchs that were hanging from the trees along one of our trails, It's that time when the monarchs have already started this incredible long distance migration where they'll end up in Mexico. They were also sort of dancing overhead a flock of there were probably 400 or 500 blackbirds in a group, and they I say dancing because you've probably seen these as you drive down the road. You've seen these they sort of move in mass literally dance in the air, kind of go back and forth across the road and up and down. And as their wings reflect, the sun reflects off their wings in different places, you'll see this this mass sort of moving, and it's quite beautiful. So we're already seeing some of that sort of thing, and roadkill. Roadkill is a big factor, and harvest of the row crop, corn and beans, has just barely started in most areas of the state. I drove across Highway 20 just last week from Highway 35, Interstate 35, over to Dubuque, and counted 50 roadkills in that distance, just on one side of the road, and most of those, the vast majority of those, were raccoons. Some skunks, a few possums, foxes, that sort of thing, but primarily raccoons. And that's really before the harvest has started. So they are literally doing this fall shuffle already.
So why do we see so much roadkill at this time of year?
Yeah, well, about in terms of raccoons and certainly skunks and possums, the young basically are moving out. They're it's sort of like teenagers going away to college, and there are a number of things that happen in the fall. It's certainly triggered by the day length, by the photo period. The shortening of the days certainly triggers them to do this. But there are lots of reasons. There's certainly food changes. They get thrown out by their parents. In the late summer, in August and early September, and we've seen some of this as well, woodchucks literally get cast out by mom and she just finally says, I've had it, you're on your own, get out of here. And she will keep the natal nesting site, and they have to find new places for homes. So they
does that go for males and females, or do the females get shoved farther away from home to create their own little population?
That would make sense, wouldn't it? But it seems as if the whole brood, doesn't matter whether they're males or females, whatever, they get tossed out and say, you're on your own. And it would make some sense often, I think, to have the females cast out a little farther, but usually it's the opposite. Males tend to maintain in most species, tend to maintain a more distinct territory and are much more territorial. So it's often the males that get tossed out. In fact, the newscasts of the bear that's in northeastern Iowa and the occasional reports we get of mountain lions, almost always those are males because male bears and male mountain lions maintain very distinct and very strict territorial boundaries, and they won't allow other males to come in there. So,
do you think that's something that a lot of species develop to maintain genetic diversity?
Well, I think it's more than that. It certainly it doesn't necessarily maintain genetic diversity in that area. It certainly casts the net pretty wide. It's probably some guarantee to maintain genetic diversity, but I think it's also a way of protecting food resources. The larger area that a male bear, for example, might have, the more food resources he has to attract a female and have her raise the cubs. So it makes some sense that way, and certainly to maintain his own genetics in the population. So I think genetic diversity has something to do with it. But in bears, it's more, I think, a matter of protecting the food resources.
Well, let's talk about raccoons for a minute, because, again, as you mentioned, that's what we're really seeing on the roads right now are
sure.
A lot of raccoons that have been hit as they go out to make their own way in the world. What do they need to do? What do the young raccoons need to do to get themselves established before it gets really cold and it gets harder to find food?
They have to do several things. Studies have shown that something in excess of 40% of the raccoon population is moving in the fall months. And in Iowa, that means they have to cross lots and lots of roads. We have, and I'm not sure what the figure is, maybe if someone from the DOT is listening, they can call in and tell me what the miles of primary roads are, but just secondary roads in the state of Iowa, we have over 89,000 miles of secondary roads. And so they're frequently crossing these roads. They're hunting for a place that they can, number one, have adequate food, number two, find shelter for the winter, and number three, find some place to get some water. But food and shelter are the most important things. Now, that may mean shacking up with a bunch of other raccoons in a crack in some rocks or deciding to share a space underneath a corn crib or in a barn or in a culvert someplace. They choose lots and lots of places to spend the winter. And they do not hibernate. Raccoons, while they do go into periods of sleep throughout the winter, living off some of their fat reserves, they're not hibernators at all. They have to maintain some activity. So they have to get up and they'll sleep for a week or two at a time, but they have to get up and find food during those winter months. So they're often out, and they have to sort of choose an area then that provides them some protection as well as a food supply.
Are they social creatures? Will they group together in the winter?
It's real interesting. I did a study for my senior project when I was at University of Wisconsin, and we put radio collars on raccoons. And at a park in southwest Wisconsin, we found there were about 35 raccoons denned up together in one crack in this in the limestone rock there, in a sort of a small mini cave area. There are a lot of raccoons that will den up together in the wintertime, and they're not all from the same family group at all. They're often, because of this fall shuffle, they're often mixed tremendously. It leads to a lot of spread of disease, particularly under for young raccoons who haven't been exposed before. You'll see a lot of raccoons that die of distemper. They're sort of stumbling along the road in the middle of the day. And it's not rabies. It's usually distemper. Their hips don't operate right. And it's often spread through the winter in these sort of mixed group of raccoons denned up together.
Well, I'm somebody who appreciates raccoons. I really have a fondness for raccoons. But I know a lot of people consider them to be a nuisance species because they do eat chickens and, they will get into your garbage can and,
sure.
and things like that. But since you've studied raccoons, tell us a little bit about them. Why should we maybe be a little more tolerant?
Well, they're an amazing adaptable amazingly adaptable critter. In fact, they're a lot like us in so many ways. It's one of the reasons they are so successful is that they've adapted to a landscape that we have essentially made. We have changed this landscape in such a way that really only the most adaptable critters are able to survive. We have modified the landscape so completely, and raccoons are one of those that have it done very, very well. They can eat a wide variety of foods. They're not just carnivorous, although they will eat meat. They're omnivorous, meaning they'll eat both whatever is available, meat, vegetable matter. So they eat this wide range of foods. They're able to adapt to what's available. They can live in a variety of places and adapt very well, and are quite dexterous. So they're able to do things like get into your garbage cans if they're not tightly sealed.
Their hands are amazing. Their paws,
really,
I guess you
are.
Should call them paws, but they really do look like hands. They don't have an opposable thumb like we do. But
it seems like it sometimes. But you're right. They don't have an opposable thumb. In fact, they're able to I've seen some places where raccoons have actually ripped off the shingles and chewed through the roof in order to get in, knowing that that's a good place to spend the winter, in your attic. You certainly don't want them there, and you certainly don't want that hole in your roof. But when you think about that, what it takes for an animal to understand that there's a hollow space inside, if they just simply remove the cover, they can get in there. It's pretty amazing when you think about that. They're very, very adaptable, very much like us, and I think that's one of the reasons they're so successful.
They are also tenacious. So if you have raccoons in your attic or are living where you really don't want them, what are some of the ways you can kindly ask them to leave?
It is difficult because once they have raccoon smell in there, they'll try every way they can to get back in. Probably the best thing to do is to relocate them, and certainly relocating them, live trapping them, moving them is not an easy thing. You need to probably get some professionals involved in that process because live trapping seems simple, but again, they're very smart critters and will not readily go into a trap without a good enticement and being sort of funneled in there, and then sealing up that entrance. But you need to remove all the evidence that they might be there, the smell that they might have in the insulation in the attic. You need to remove that sort of stuff so that they can't smell their way back in there, and then really seal up that entrance. Move them probably 20, 25 miles away in suitable habitat so that they can find a place, lots of hollow trees, downed logs, that sort of thing, that they could overwinter in successfully.
We'll continue this conversation in a moment. My guest today is wildlife consultant Jim Pease, and you are welcome to join the conversation. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it is Wildlife Day today with wildlife consultant Jim Pease. And today we're talking about doing the fall shuffle, all of the changes that take place this time of year as some animals migrate, others move around a little bit while they're looking for a better place to spend the winter. We were talking before the break about raccoons and some of the other creatures that get kicked out of the family unit and have to make their own way in the world. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have any questions or maybe some signs of fall that you've seen, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We were talking about raccoons, and you mentioned that they do not hibernate. And I think that's something a lot of people believe about raccoons, that they
right.
go into hibernation. They think they're just small bears of some kind.
Yeah, and in fact, they're really not. They do get up and eat. They do try to have some winter stores of food, but they will get up sometimes even if the winter den gets too cold, where they are spending a good deal of time, they'll actually move around to try other den sites. They may try underneath your front porch or your deck, that sort of thing. They're not hibernators at all.
Well, and they are real opportunists. I grew up in a family of wildlife rehabilitators, and we raised raccoons. And one year we ended up with about 6 that were overwintering with us because people had tried to keep them as pets, which is illegal and a terrible idea.
Right. Yeah,
and,
terrible idea.
So I was a teenager, and it was my job to go out and feed these raccoons, which were out in an outbuilding at night, and it was very cold. And one night I went out there, and there was a raccoon outside of the building, and it wasn't the... You know, it was a very old building. So
was it one of the 6?
I thought it probably got out. So I picked it up by the nape of its neck and I held it as I opened the door and I shone my flashlight around and there were 6 raccoons in there already. So I was just holding a neighborhood raccoon, which isn't a good idea.
No,
but
not a good
idea. It didn't mind. It just said, I'll have some dog food too.
Sure. Sure.
But they do find ways to get
you know
food.
I've had people call me over the years with lots and lots of phone calls, but some of the funniest ones are the raccoons that have learned how to use the pet door into the porch, and they come in and they eat the cat food, and I've said, well, you know, and they didn't like this, and I said, well, you can raccoons are very adaptable and they're creatures of habit. They will do the same thing as long as the food's there. They'll be there every night. And so you have to stop that behavior. And you could, I suppose, nail the pet door shut, but then the cats couldn't get out. So what you want to do is feed your cat in the morning and then in the evening take away all the food. Make sure that there's no food out there. The raccoon will come, may even knock on the door and say, hey, where's my food? Ignore them. And after a couple of nights, it won't be a problem. And I had one person tell me, well, my cats won't eat during the day. And I said, oh, after a couple of days, they will. They're pretty smart, too. But you have to change that behavior. And as you say, they're very opportunistic, and they will take advantage of whatever is available.
Well, let's talk about who actually does hibernate. So we know that raccoons don't. What are our true hibernators here in Iowa?
Well, the ground squirrels primarily, woodchucks, and they won't be going into hibernation in a little bit, depends on the weather. They certainly respond to the day length, but probably late October up to mid-November before they go into hibernation. 13-line ground squirrels and Franklin's ground squirrels, all of those are true hibernators. They do live off their fat reserves all winter. Bats are another one that are actually true hibernators. And they are on the move right now as well. They are, well, we don't usually see large flocks of bats like we do sometimes see birds moving, because bats migrate, most of the migration takes place at night. But they're certainly taking advantage right now. If you go out in the evening, they're taking advantage of the abundant insect populations that are still available. And boy, have we had abundant insect populations this summer, particularly mosquitoes. And the bats are taking advantage of that to fatten up, to put together enough fat reserves where they can survive the winter months, that winter hibernation period.
And why do the bats move? If they migrate, why don't they just, or not, if they hibernate, why don't they just stay where they are and hibernate where they've been living all summer?
Great question. Because it usually the places that they choose for summer roosts are not adequate for winter hibernation. Winter hibernation has to take place in places, while they can drop their body temperature, ground squirrels are the same way. If they don't dig deep enough and the frost goes so deep that it surrounds them, they won't survive the winter, because basically the temperature around them has to be right around or just above freezing, and that's true with bats as well. If it drops too far below that, they use up their fat reserves too quickly, and they literally freeze to death, so they don't emerge in the spring. And bats are the same way, so they need to hibernate. They need to find a place that is just above or right around freezing and maintains a constant humidity. So they will often migrate. They don't necessarily migrate south, as we think of that. They'll sometimes migrate north because the best caves may be farther north. I've been in places as far north as central Minnesota that had hibernating bats in caves through the winter because it was this airflow. So we'll often see bats in Iowa migrate towards eastern Iowa, particularly northeastern Iowa, where we have caves that they will spend the winter in. And it's led to that sort of grouping behavior, just as it has with raccoons, has led to some problems that are just emerging in bats. You may have heard of white nose syndrome. This is a fungal disease that appears to be associated with a virus, and it's killing literally millions of overwintering bats. It started on the East Coast and has gradually spread westward, and it appears to be in the vicinity of eastern Iowa bat caves, overwintering bat caves right now. So we're very concerned that even our most common bats, the big brown bat, could be subjected to severe population losses.
Well, I read an article just recently saying that it was possible that within a decade there could be no bats in northeastern North America.
Yeah, it's probably an exaggeration. Like most diseases, things adapt. You know, they develop a resistance to them. Some bats are going to be resistant to it, and that genetics, hopefully, the genetics will allow it. But it certainly means that for many years, the bat populations will be severely reduced from what they are now, and that insect control that they provide won't be there for us.
Bob is on the line at 866-780-9100 from Cedar Falls. Hello, Bob.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, my brother and I had a coon when we were younger. And, of course, we had to get rid of it because it started to get wild. And you know, it's not good to really have a coon for a pet, you know, when they're young.
Right.
So, but, yeah. You know, that's just the comment that I wanted to mention. Because, I mean, the one day that where we had the coon, it got out. And of course, Dad was out doing the chores, and it decided to climb Dad as a tree. And,
right.
And our little dog, she didn't like the coon being outside, so...
So. Yeah, it can be. There are several problems with it. Certainly, these are wild critters, and the wildness doesn't go out of them just because that they've become accustomed to your feeding them. But because they are accustomed to your feeding them, they're used to people. They see people as sources of food. Or in this case, as you say, the climbing apparatus, they can get into trouble later in life because they don't have the fear or natural rejection of human beings. Also, they can get dependent on that. And you certainly, aside from, I mean, the reason it's illegal is because of all these things that it creates conditioned animals, it creates dependency, it often can, they can harbor diseases that don't appear right away, such things as distemper and rabies that they are probably not vaccinated for, can spread to pets and humans and other things. There are all sorts of reasons, and that's why it's illegal. It's not just that it's illegal, but that's why. And you're absolutely right. I appreciate your pointing that out.
We had an email from Dan in Albion, and he said, we also had trouble with raccoons going through the cat door in our garage. Uh-huh. I solved the problem by leaving the radio on, tuned to WOI-AM, since it's talk radio all night long, to keep them out. He said it worked great with the raccoons, but the possums seem to enjoy listening to the news as much as I do.
They're much mellower. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there are all sorts of folk remedies out there. You know, you mentioned earlier about what kinds of things you can get to, you questioned about, to get them to leave. And there are everything from, you know, people have tried mothballs and ammonia-soaked rags. And basically, they don't like that stuff. But you'd have to put enough mothballs up there, particularly if you have a large area in the attic, and enough ammonia-soaked rags up there that would cause you to leave the house as well, to really cause them to leave. They'll certainly change locations within your attic, but then that just complicates the problem. So really, removal is the best option. Radios, so-called ultrasonic devices, none of those things have proven, through science experiments, have proven effective at all, unfortunately. I wish they did.
Well, and I've heard a lot of stories about raccoons learning how to turn off radios or tune radios and things like
tune
that.
Tune it to a station they want, right?
Right. They love pop.
Maybe they like do the shuffle. You know? They like to dance. That's it. Yeah.
It could be. The number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. If you've seen signs of fall in the wildlife around your neighborhood, if you have any questions, let us know. Boyd is on the line from Crawfordsville. He called 866-780-9100. Hello, Boyd.
Yes. Mr. Pete, I was wondering, we had a barn owl move into our barn here about a month or so ago.
Oh, really?
What'll winter bring for him?
Oh, is this truly a barn owl, the sort of monkey-faced owl?
Yep. Ooh, yep. Just a single one. I don't know whether he's a young one. My bird books aren't that detailed, but
that's terrific. He's probably moving in there for a very specific reason. And owls are one of the critters that will stick around all winter, and they're very active all winter long. And there's certainly some of barn owls in particular, some of our best mousers and ratters in existence. I ask you what it was for sure, because barn owls are quite rare in the state, and there have been lots of attempts to reestablish them in greater numbers. They're a fairly adaptable owl in that their range is very large. It goes clear down into South America. And some subspecies, if you're a splitter, certainly go down into South America. But they haven't done well here in Iowa, and it appears to be, first of all, the loss of our traditional barn habitat and the change in farming methods so that we're not storing grain, so we have lots of mice and rats of eating that grain, and they subsisted on that. And they also don't seem to compete very well with great horned owls. And great horned owls, sort of the tiger of the landscape, have been seen to not only drive them out, but to kill and eat them. The barn owls.
How big is a barn owl when he's mature?
When they're mature, let's see. I'm looking at my hands here. They're about maybe 16, 18 inches high. They're not that big an owl.
Okay, well, this one isn't very big, and that's what I thought. Maybe he was a young one because we've never had anything like that before. But
right.
He moved into our barn about a month ago, and he's very faithful. I don't think he's there every day and gone every night.
That's terrific.
Wow, that's really cool.
With
great horned owls, you can tell if they're juvenile or adult by the sounds that they make. Can you tell with barn owls?
No, because barn owls don't have a hoot. All they have is a hiss. And while they do make some food cries, the great horned owls have this terrific food cry. In fact, you can still hear them at night. Certain parents are still feeding their young, even though they're very capable of finding their own food. Barn owls, it's not possible to tell. More than likely, you can probably see the difference by the feather patterns and make sure that they're all fully feathered out. Have any of that.
Will there be enough mice and rats and whatnot when it gets down zero and snow on the ground for him?
Hopefully, yes.
Okay.
It certainly depends on how much snow we have, whether they can get the voles that live way down right on the ground level underneath the snow. They'll certainly take other small mammals, but mice and rats are really the staple food supply for them. So
would he tackle a pigeon?
No, they're not very good at it.
Well, there were feathers in the barn one morning, and I thought maybe that was...
It's certainly possible, but it wouldn't be. Most barn owls can't fly quick enough to catch a pigeon on the wing, although I suppose they could take one off a roost at night. So that's certainly possible.
Does Boyd need to make sure that if he has cats, they're inside at night?
Oh, no, I wouldn't mind losing a cat or two.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Boyd, thank you so much for your call. The number to call is 866-780-9100. And we've been talking about animals that don't hibernate, mm-hmm. animals that do hibernate. Let's talk about the true migrators, the ones that travel a long way. You talked about the monarch butterflies,
right.
and they're grouping up right now.
Yeah, we're seeing groups of them begin to, you still will find, in fact, I just found on a partially plant that we have in our sort of kitchen garden there. I found just this week a really nice monarch caterpillar still feeding. For the most part, most of them have pupated and gone to adulthood and have actually are beginning that migration. We'll certainly see lots of other things moving as well. Some of the mass migration, some of them are, though, Charity, are just changing from their summer range to their winter range. And we'll certainly see that with the deer population over the next month, month and a half. And it's a very good reason for Iowans to change your driving habits, especially in the early morning and evening hours when you're going to and from work, because that's when the deer are, and other critters in particular, are moving, and you may come into contact with them. We'll also see migrations. You may have noticed big kettles, what are called kettles, groups of turkey vultures together. And you think, oh, they must have found something dead out there. Not necessarily. They're certainly hunting for that. But they are beginning their migration as well, rising on these air currents, these thermals that are coming off of dark areas in the landscape. And we're often seeing flocks of 40, 50, 60 turkey vultures together in this big flying kettle. And it's quite dramatic. It's quite a beautiful thing to watch.
We're talking with wildlife consultant Jim Pease today about the fall migration patterns and the movements that animals make as they're getting ready for winter. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm here today with wildlife consultant Jim Pease, and we're talking about fall migration and other ways that animals are getting ready for the winter months. And Jim, we had a question from Twitter. Jess wants to know if we could discuss the way that climate change is affecting animals and if it's affecting migration patterns.
It's a really interesting question, and I think the answer is we don't know. Certainly climate change will have some effect on how far south they go for winter, where they choose to overwinter. The big impact of climate change are sort of at the edges of the climate, if you will. We tend to see more extremes in weather patterns. So you'll get extreme drought or extreme abundance of moisture. We'll get extreme storms. Those are the kinds of things we're seeing kind of across the world. How those events will impact where critters migrate to and from is really up for grabs. And I think we can say with some certainty that some critters will be more adaptable than we imagined, and others will not. And depending on the degree to which that climate changes and the speed with which it changes, it will certainly impact them. But I think most studies that are done on this are just beginning now, and it will be certainly there will be lots of folks willing to make predictions. Whether those will come to pass will, I think, remains to be seen. It's a very good question, though.
Sally is on the line from Marshalltown at 866-780-9100. Hello, Sally.
Hi.
What's your question?
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Sally.
This isn't particularly related to the fall migrations, but I'm just interested in what the current status of some less common mammals are, like the badger, and do we still have spotted skunks in Iowa?
Great questions. Spotted skunks, the answer is almost no. It's one of those critters that when we don't pay attention sometimes, kind of gradually disappears from the landscape. Our farming methods in particular were in the early part of the most of the 20th century up until about the 1970s, really favored habitat for spotted skunks. We had mixed farms and lots of livestock, and they often were found around these smaller farms and farmsteads because they fed very, very heavily on mice and rats and were some of the, like the barn owls I mentioned earlier, some of our best ratters. But what happened was, as the farming and the landscape changed, very slowly the spotted skunk lost its habitat and was taken over by the striped skunk. And spotted skunks have disappeared. We know of about one small population in the state now. We've done some live trapping in other areas where we thought they would be, and we have not found them at all. So they're not in good shape at all. Badgers, on the other hand, have done very, very well. Badgers are in the Mustelids, the weasel family, and they're though large predators, they've done pretty well in recent years. They dig down and are able to feast on abundant ground squirrel populations, and they can range quite widely. And they've done very, very well. So we frequently, in fact, I saw on Highway 20 last week, I was mentioning as I traveled across the state, I did see a dead badger on the side of the road as well. So badgers are more frequently seen in literally all over the state and are doing fairly well.
But badgers had nearly disappeared, hadn't they?
Yes, they had. Due to overexploitation and, quite frankly, loss of sufficient habitat, probably the grassland restoration programs through CRP and some of those certainly helped them. The other thing that happens is that the terracing of the landscape and the planting of those terraces with grasses allows ground squirrels to come in and therefore food supply for badgers. They've also done very well in urban areas, especially around golf courses. Golf courses often have 13-line ground squirrel populations, and badgers take advantage of that.
Badgers are really wary of humans, though, aren't they?
Yes.
They're difficult to see.
That's right. They're quite wary of humans, and they are tough to see. They're very defensive, and quite excellent predators on ground squirrel populations.
Sally, thank you so much for your call. And next up, we have Barbara in Toledo. Hello, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is about bat houses. About 3 years ago, I had some bats in my house. I had them eradicated using the proper way they use the bat door and all that. But before that was done, I put up two bat houses, one for the boys and one for the girls. But no bats. I got them out of the house. But mm-hmm. No bats have ever lived in those houses.
Yeah. It's a common observation. The bat houses in Iowa are at best summer roosts. Only they will not hibernate there. It's not warm enough
sure.
for them to make it through the winter. So they're summer roosts, and the studies nationwide have shown that after 2 to 3 years, you might get 50 to 60% of them occupied, and yours was in the other
uh-huh.
half, and that's quite common. They either have to for one reason or another, they don't like it. It may be the wrong location, maybe the wrong height. It doesn't smell like bats. It smells too clean for them, or it doesn't have that bat urine smell. They will go back to the same place year after year after year, and they find that place, we think, in part by their sense of smell and also by visual signals that tell them where to go. And they remember that from year to year. They're quite interesting critters. And the bat houses don't have that smell. So some people have said that you can increase the chance of occupancy of a bat house by putting some bat feces from your attic or something like
uh-huh.
that in the bat house so that it at least smells like bats. And you may have a better chance at getting some occupancy.
Well, maybe part of the problem is we put them on the windmill about 20 feet up, and now
uh-huh.
they've put a yard light up, and that may discourage them, too.
Well, it may be the motion of the windmill, too,
the
vibration of that. They may not like that. You know, there could be lots of reasons. It may be the direction they're facing. There may be a vine that's too close. It's hard to tell. Interviewing them is rather difficult, so we haven't been able to find out exactly what they like, you know.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
And so, bye-bye. Jim, if you wanted to get your hands on some bat guano, mm-hmm. to perform that trick, where would you find some bat guano?
Well,
and by that I mean feces, if you're not familiar
right.
with the term.
Yeah, very often people are trying to do this by evicting them from their house, but they still want them around, but they just don't want them in their house, and I understand that. So you can usually find those droppings very readily in your attic before or after you evict them. You could also go to a city or county park shelter, a picnic shelter, and very often you'll find the bat droppings right below where the bats are roosting, and they'll often roost there in the summer, and you'll find some of those droppings right there.
All right. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 866-780-9100. It's also supposed to be tremendous fertilizer if you're
yes,
a gardener.
Yes, it is. Yes, that's right.
Susan sent us an email from St. Ansgar High School. She's a biology teacher, and she says, I came across a nest of four baby goldfinches while doing some photography on Labor Day, mm-hmm. and they appeared to be just a few days old. Can you tell us about goldfinch habits in the fall and winter?
Right. Goldfinches are very late nesters, they nest late in the summer rather than in the springtime like most other birds. In fact, you'll notice as the birds, if you keep feeders up all summer, the males tend to get their brightest colors midsummer, and you say, well, gee, that's kind of opposite everything else. And yes, indeed it is. In fact, they often will not nest until the down of the thistle is available, because that's what they often line their nests with, is thistle down. And that means that they're mid to late summer nesters. Now, this particular one, if indeed they were only a few days old on Labor Day, that was a particularly late nester. But if you think about that, from a species standpoint, it makes some sense. Here's a bird that has been successful by nesting later in the year, and it doesn't want to, excuse the pun, put all its eggs in one basket.
Not resist that.
No, I couldn't. but it wants to kind of spread out that breeding, so that they may or may not make it. But on the other hand, if they do, then they tend to be very late nesters themselves. Maybe there's some genetic carryover then from the parents. So that allows you to spread out your breeding time and maybe be more successful and to adapt to the kinds of changes that maybe climate change and other things are bringing to them. So species that have very narrow range of possibilities probably don't do well under fast change. Species that are more adaptable and have the genetics in the population that maybe less nest later or earlier do better. So it is a late nest, but if indeed they were just a few days old, but it's not out of the realm of possibility
and
at all.
Birds grow very, very quickly.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
I've never seen a baby goldfinch or a fledgling goldfinch hopping around on the ground. Are they a kind of bird that fledges directly into the air, or do they hop around for a day or so?
They'll usually do what's called branching. They'll get out from that nest, and because they're often in low shrubs or tall grasses on a prairie, or particularly on things like silphiums, the cup plant, and some of those taller prairie plants. You'll often see them nesting there, and they'll get out on the leaves and the branches of the shrub or the plant, and spend some time exercising their wings. But they go pretty quickly.
Peter is on the line from Iowa City. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
When I'm driving, I see animals.
Okay, Peter, I'm sorry. We're going to have to let you go. I apologize, but we can't understand you at all. I don't know if you were in a really windy place or what. I apologize. Try again. Anne is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Anne.
Yes, I live on a farm. I have an old barn and some pole sheds and other outbuildings, and I don't use them anymore. And they're just filled with all types of wildlife, from the owl, you know, just name it, I've got it in there. But eventually, I know as they start to go down, I'm going to have to tear these buildings down. Mm-hmm. How can I plan ahead so that the animals that are in there now would have areas, because I do have some wood areas and that, like for the owls, should I build something out there? You know, what should I put out there that if I need to as these buildings go down? And also, what time of year is the best time to tear these buildings down?
That's a great question, and I you know, the answer means it depends. Depends on what the species are that you're in particular interested in making certain they have homes. The woodchucks that are probably in there will find someplace else. They'll certainly dig a hole in another location without a problem. Owls, you can. Most owls are hole nesters. And depending on the species of owls, you can provide artificial nesting boxes for them. There is a publication available through your county extension office or through the extension website called Shelves, Houses, and Feeders for Birds and Mammals. And we'll give you a lot of plans, and you can probably grab some off the internet as well, for building houses, putting them in the woods. Unless your woods is has a lot of dead standing trees, you may in fact need to provide some holes, some dens for them, and that would certainly assist them. There's no guarantee that they'll do it, but they'll probably adapt pretty well.
Okay, because I do leave the dead trees in there for the peckers and all of that.
Good, good. That's great.
And so then, because I have a huge owl in there,
great.
Enormous one.
Uh-huh.
So.
That's
and I just
terrific.
Didn't want to kick him out. So is kind of early fall better? Because late fall, then I think, well, then they have no place to go for the winter. And spring, I think they've got their babies. And...
Yeah, I would say midsummer is probably best.
All right. Good luck with that project, Anne. And we're nearly out of time. We have an email from Brian who says, I used to see meadowlarks and blue jays around Waterloo all the time as a child. I live in Marion now, and I rarely see them.
Yeah, it they certainly have their populations go up and down with the available habitat, and around cities you see that habitat changing very, very rapidly. Of course, meadowlarks are one of the species that has lost a lot of habitat, grassland habitat in the state, particularly as CRP has gone out of that. But and as grasslands get taken over by housing developments, that cancels out any ability for them to nest. Blue jays are a little more adaptable, but they've been their populations go up and down yearly, and you may notice some short-term changes that over the long run that tend to do okay.
Brian also wants to know if there's been a turkey vulture comeback, because he says he rarely saw them 10 years ago and now he sees them all the time.
Yeah, there has been, as a matter of fact. They've learned to adapt, and what you're mostly seeing during the summer, unless you have some nesting nearby, you have sort of bachelor or bachelorette groups, because they tend to they need to be several years old before they're into the breeding population, and you're seeing these singles singles groups that for the most part are hanging around cities. We have some right here in Ames and Des Moines and Iowa City. They're all over the place, and we have seen an increase in turkey vulture populations.
So what is your favorite thing, Jim, as the weather starts to get colder? What is the thing that you really look for with wildlife?
Well, the things that I mentioned at the top of the hour are the things that I really love to see. It used to be the call of Canada geese in the fall. That was the sign that fall was really happening. But they're so common now, and in so many different areas, I look for things like the grouping up of the monarchs, the kettles of the turkey vultures in the sky, and the disappearance of birds. The warblers are already gone for the most part. You may have a few species that will hang around. The hummingbirds that are in feeding swarms right now and maybe coming through on your feeders. Those are all things that are really spectacular, I think, to watch. Subtle changes in our landscape that if we're open to it, we'll and keep our eyes open, begin to notice things, you'll be able to change with the seasons.
Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Jim Pease is an environmental, interpretive, and wildlife consultant based in Ames, and he joins us once a month. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support comes from Ben Yeager in Ames. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org and look for us on Twitter at IPR Talk and on Facebook. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, a conversation with Peter Buffett and Scott Simon.